you get into an experiment, something we call a line is an experience. That is, I've had time to go from here to there, something else has gone from here to there. I may have scribed, and may have altered the system by scraping something off of it, and there's a trajectory. We are talking about trajectories of experience when we talk about lines. Now, physics has found no straight lines. That's quite impressive. Found only waves. And yet, this mathematician talking about straight lines. And mathematician talking about solids, and physics has found no solids. And the mathematician talking about surfaces, and the physicist found no continuums. I just wanted to point out that they really are, the mathematician operating there, the fact when we begin to get into actions and what nature really does, we have a trajectory, another trajectory. There's one object already in this, another one comes in, they have what we call an interference. They can't, no two lines in physics can go through the same point at the same time. If they have an interference and there's a reflection or a refraction, a smash up, or a critical huddle. But you don't, mass subtractive huddle or something like that, but you don't have any two lines going through the same point. Therefore, if two lines could go through the same point at the same time, there'd be no reflection or refraction, no consciousness. So I just want to show you how really far off the mathematician really is, and his basic start is therefore his ratio that he's pondering on is inherently irrelevant because it has no identification. He's too inaccurate in relation to the extraordinary phenomenon of life. So he's a callous man, and he's really quite arrogant about it. I have had enormous numbers of students who said, you know, my mathematician, and students find a very inspiring mathematician, and they feel, my mathematics teacher is going to like you very much, and I'm going to bring him around to your lecture. And I've been introduced to many mathematics professors just before my lecture, and they very polite, sit right in the middle of the front row. I haven't been going 5 minutes before they leave the room. I'm just inherently irritating the mathematician. But I really can remember being facetious with my... I really like mathematics, by the way, because I like the idea of being able to develop a strategy of proofs. That's a very great thing. And so you can get answers, and whether my handwriting was messy or whether the teacher liked my looks, I could get good marks in mathematics, and I did. I got A's. But the many things I was being taught by my mathematician, that I remember my first little teacher, just high school teacher, she wasn't really profound in mathematics anyway, but she said, she was giving me what she'd learned. So she went to the board and made all these, said, here's a little dot there, there's a point, which said doesn't exist, so she wiped it. And I'm going to take a number of these points that don't exist, put them side by side, and make sure we draw a line, but said that doesn't exist. She went. Then she put a number of these lines side by side, made a raft. She said, that's a plane, but said, that doesn't exist. So then she stacked these planes up on top of each other, came and said, now it's a cube, said, that exists. So you wonder how it could exist in the power of non-existence. And I said, the word exists, I said, how old is it? She said, please don't be naughty. I said, what does it weigh? And said, you're going to have to stay after school. So I said, how hot is it? I was trying to think very possibly, because I felt about what do we call existence? And there's heat, and there's what does it weigh, and how old is it? And she didn't have any answer. So this ghost cube here, I couldn't really field really as yet existed, and I didn't think she really knew what she was talking about. But I saw how she handled her game, and the universe has such extraordinary laws in here that even playing a game carelessly, it came out pretty well. Now, I have then been with many mathematicians on the straight line business. I said, all right, show me a straight line. And they draw something. Look, here's my glasses. It's very, very rough. It's very crooked. It's just, so you've got smearing a lot of dirt around on here. Bathsheba said, I want you to understand, I'm talking about a purely imaginary straight line. Absolutely perfectly imaginary straight line. I said, where'd you get this image business? We must go back to our experience. And if you want something that is not identifiable, any experience, you can't use my word line, for instance. That's some sounds that I learned to make in relation to experience. You can't use any of the language we have. All those nice languages, the letters we write it in, and the chalk that I've invented in. To be able to do this, these are all experiential. And they're not, none of them imaginary whatsoever. And you won't be able to communicate with me. No. So, Master said, I mean a line of sight now. I said, well, that's fine. We find now that it takes light 8 minutes to come to us from the sun. We put our transit on the sign of the point is kissing the horizon in the evening. And we find that because it takes light 8 minutes to come to us, the sun hasn't been there for 8 minutes. So you're looking around the curvature of the earth. So I said, obviously that's a curved line. And the mathematician said, you're very annoying, I've got it. So I said, you're going to just, Mr. Mathematician, you're getting more and more trouble, and I'm going to give you an out. I'm going to take a deliberately non-straight line, which is what we do find in physics. I'm going to take this deliberately non-straight line. For instance, I'm going to take a piece of rope, and you see it's all twisty right away. I'm going to splice the two ends together. One of your definitions of a straight line is that it never returns upon itself. I'm deliberately making it return upon itself by splicing the ends of the rope together. I'm going to have to leave the room. I'll be right back. I'm also very factual about everything. Non-straight line, I took a piece of rope, which could not seem to be more crooked, and bring it back his hands on himself. So we've done everything to be non-straight. With this piece of rope with the now joined together, so it's a loop. And this is a finite closure. Now I'm going to take a hold of any two parts of it, bring them side by side, start massaging it along like this, these two parts, paralleling them, more or less paralleling, because obviously they're not a straight line, so they're in company, in close company. I move it to the end, and get to where the rope makes a loop like that, and I squeeze just as tight as I can, and in the middle of the loop, and I put a little pink string on it. Now I massage it the other way very carefully to get to where I get a loop in the other. Put a pink string on there. Now I had unity and I've halved unity fairly satisfactorily. We could do it a little more accurately each time. But this is, by the Heisenberg, you cannot be absolutely exact, so this is a reasonably accurate halving. I'm going to take the two pink ribbon parts, loops, and bring them together. Now I've got four parts, I massage them. I get two other loops over here, and I put two other colored strings on it. And I've got four divisions over here, so I've divided this into approximate quarters unity. You go on the same way, pairing, and have many subdivisions you want. You go on to eighths and sixteenths and 32nds and 64ths. Okay. But I marked the eighths a different color from the fourths and so forth. Now with those markings, I can go to the wall and I ask you to help me. And so we put a nail in the wall here and put one of the pinks on there. And you hold the pink on there with your, on your rope. No, no. You can do what you want. And I'm going to get them. While you hold up, I'm going to go to the second pink or a quarter point. And I'm going to pull the rope firmly, and I could make a radius. You're holding it firmly, so I have just got the rope stretched. This is Dacron rope, and it stays stable structurally, and get a good firm pulling on it. And I get to that place where I'll put in another nail here and put the rope over that, the pink, next pink. As you can see, it's on a radius of anything you want to put it there. Now, I get somebody else to hold it on there while you hold this one. Now, to take long to keep on the rope till I come to the next pink or the what would have been the first half point. And that also could be as on a radius, but I'll choose to put it here and put a nail in. And somebody, the third person holds that for me. Now I've got this line, I've got this free part here, and there's a pink down here, it's loose, and I pull it firmly. And I come down to a point which is equidistant from the starting point and equidistant from there, and put another nail. Now I come back and look at this, and it's a diamond. It was like that. It might be slanting that way, the diamond, according to what I put in that second or the third nail. But at any rate, there's a diamond. And these are equal increments, and it's on an approximate plane. It's not a true plane at all, but it agrees very nicely with what we've been calling an equilateral parallelogram, which we then learned by other of our geometrical investigation that the angles could be two angles of two sides and two other angles in it. Okay. Now, I'm going to, knowing it's an equilateral parallelogram, I'm now going up this side here. There was an eighth point, and it is blue. There's another eighth point descending over here, the middle of that edge of the diamond. There's another blue point mid-edge of that one, another blue point here mid-edge of the diamond. I'm going to put nails in at these blue points, and I'm going to take the rope off of the top of the diamond here, pink, and pull it down. So it went up the blue point here, and I pull it down here in the middle. And this is the same distance from here to here, up to that blue point. I put in a nail. Then, on the downside of the diamond here, where's the blue point, I put in a nail, and I put a nail in the blue point there, and I take it off the bottom of the diamond here, big diamond, and just simply move it up to here. So you see now, I've now made two diamonds with that total of 8 inches, which we knew by measurement were actually equal. So we got parallelogram, they got two diamonds. What I did was take then a lambda and convert it into an M. I took a V and I converted it into a W. Now I'm going to take each one of those diamonds and take their halfway points and do exactly the same. I'm going to make each diamond into a two diamonds. Now I've got four diamonds. The end is still, so they're four diamonds end to end. See that all right? Take them, the four diamonds, and make them into eight diamonds. And then each time I do it, the overall length remains the same, but the altitude this way is exactly halving each time. The whole of this array of diamonds getting narrower and narrower, but it's exactly the same length. I don't have to get up to very high frequency before they approach each other so closely that you can't even see the difference. as I have a way now of increasing the frequency of subdivision and getting this, then I have a method of making this thing approach straightness. The mathematician didn't have any way of approaching his straightness. I'm not saying I'm getting there, because I started deliberately straight, non-straight line. I know it's a non-straight line. But again, you've looked much more like something you call straight than anything had before. So now we have a physicist, and he wants to introduce his students to what this extraordinary phenomenal wave, which he finds to be absolutely everywhere in the no straight lines. And he finds a very easy way of demonstrating a wave. Because waves have a very interesting characteristic. They're always cyclic. They come back where they start. So he takes, we physicist will put a nail on the wall and put fasten a rope to it, and then he throws a whip into the rope, and the wave goes to the wall and comes back to the town and stops. This is very typical of your person experiencing this wonderful characteristic of a wave that comes back where it started. We don't have any partial waves. They have to be whole waves. It's just fundamental to a wave. You can't have a gear that's three quarters of a gear. it always must be a complete cycle. Now, what we have up on the wall here then, because it does start here and it's waves and goes over to this end here, very high frequency, where you and I can't see the altitude of the wave height at all anymore. It looks like a straight line, but it actually is a wave going in, coming all the way back where it started. That's where we meet. So we have up here on the wall a device which gets straighter and straighter. That is, the waves simply get the wavelength gets smaller and smaller. Frequency is increasing, and the wavelength is getting smaller and smaller, but it's always non-straight. Pure wavelength. And in every way it corresponds. This is what the mathematician was talking about when he said a line of sight. This is it. I'm given now the mathematician. Here is a much straighter line than you were ever able to draw, Mr. Mathematician. In fact, I can really describe it mathematically much more accurately. First time you really describe a straight line mathematically. That's wavelinear. Don't call it straight anymore. Just call it a line. Wavelinear line. And now you can do all the geometries you ever did with this very nice device, which is much more controllable than the lines you used to make on the wall when you start talking geometry. When you asked me to call it an absolute imaginary line. This is the first time that the mathematician really began to be friendly to me. See, he had a chance now to get into the exact sciences. Put him on an experiential basis instead of that. Now, I want to give you a nice experience with me, and all this I just said to you, I really followed through very intuitively and went through a long number of years of being befriended by the physicists, the chemists and so forth, the mathematician being very unfriendly to me. And then suddenly he's really yielding my way now, because I've given him an advantage. He's getting on into the experience. He said long ago in the new mathematics that I want to give up axioms, but he really didn't know how. He knew he was in hot water with axioms, but he didn't know how to get experience. Yes, sir.
Would you please take your wave line, and science is experience, and contract the length of the wave line? Do we experience? Contract the length of the loop that we started with, yeah. The diameter, the circumference, right. Whatever, and bring it down. And when do we become to the place of thought that we experience completely internally?
I'm going to have to say a couple more things along with what you're saying. First place, I want to recognize that rope did consist of atoms. I talked last night about mass subtraction. And the atoms really were in a, there were a number of different kinds of atoms, and sometimes they're in such chemical relations where you have smaller ones interposing between others, so you can get very great strength. So we simply have a Milky Way of atoms. There's no absolute continuity here at all. Be sure that we understand that. And we, so that I can't really contract that rope down to a point. Understand me? It really is a complex of events. I have to deal with whatever that complex of events may be, that particular atomic array. So it is a Milky Way that I was playing with. The insideness and outsideness business, I did give you a way of thinking about that in terms of, our time I have is very limited, but I began to ponder also in the same kind of way about the fact that I was told that hearing deafness and blindness and so forth, that these were more or less alternate. The fact we had four different kinds of senses, and you lose one but you have the other, so a safety factor. And the insurance companies treat the loss of a hand the same as loss of an eye. And I wonder if they really were the same. So I began to go into, again, personal experience. I'm going to start then by blindfolding myself. And I cover up my nostrils, my mouth. I'm going to have to give a tube of some oxygen, so I'm going to keep you alive. And I'm going to cover up your ears. You can't hear. You have only your skin. So whatever you're going to know about life during this experiment right now, you have to get through by touch. And you're blindfolded, therefore you're not going to rush over here. You're only going to move when you feel you're testing whether it's really strong enough to dare to throw your weight. So you'll be doing this, and you put your hand in front of your face so you don't run into something, trying to sort of guard yourself all the time as you... You find yourself acting like any insect, using all these terminals to get information that they ought to be able to dare to proceed. And you feel things, but try to remember this where they are sort of geometrically around you. So you begin to develop some information locally about what seems to be around. As a child, you learn that there's a path, a country place. And you get so familiar with that path that you sort of find that if they let you out at night and you run down that path and you never really draw ready for those curves, you feel them with your feet. You're so familiar with that path. So as this kind of man might from time to time dare to run the path that he feels it fast with his feet. So I have this man, however, I'm going to have to take a good big one, this big basketball player. In fact, it's phenomenal. And it's 10 feet from this toe to this finger here. The total range of his reaching for information is then 10 feet, a sphere 10 feet. But he moves the sphere around, so he gets some increase in information by motion. I'm able to run on the path here locally. I have what I call a static range of information, which is 10 feet or diameter, might be 5 foot radius. And then also I'm adding to it the rate at which you could run. And 10 miles an hour is about to be very much of an optimum in here. So I got 10 miles an hour. You have only a whole lifetime. The amount of information you get regarding total universe is going to be relatively small. Now I'm going to cover up all your skin so you don't have that for information anymore. And I'm going to free your nostrils and your mouth. The ears are covered up and the eyes are covered up. And now, this is all you're going to get about information about your universe. You can't move anymore, your legs. That's part of the tactile. Men have sailors coming in from the sea, having been at sea for a long time, coming in night and fogs, have been able to smell citrus groves about a mile offshore when no wind is blowing. The concentration of the gases are such that they're actually recognizable a mile away. Also of some of the pines. So a static range of olfactory is about a mile, in contradistinction tactile of being 10 feet. Then, however, the winds are very often flowing. The winds may blow up to get up to one of the enormous Arctic and Antarctic high-speed circling. We get up to 400 miles an hour winds. So the wind might bring things to you as it does forest fire smells, where the jet stream is moving 400 miles an hour. It still keeps it concentrated enough for you to recognize it really great distances away. So I got the static range of smelling is 1 mile, and the dynamic is 400 miles an hour. Now it's really very different from the tactile, where we have 10 feet and 10 miles an hour. Bring up to 400 miles an hour. Now I'm going to cover up your nose and mouth, and all your skin is covered up, and just the ears are open now. You see animals are really doing this with their ears. And what do we know about this? Men have heard atomic bomb blasts 100 miles. That seems to be the static range of hearing. Hearing being, then we're talking about disturbances in air waves. So 100 miles is a recognition. We have then the speed of sound of 700 miles an hour approximately. But if the wind is blowing also, then at 700 miles an hour that is, so you have to have 400 miles of the jet stream to 700 miles, so you find that you might hear at a rate of 1,100 miles an hour. Information might come to you, but your static range is 100. Now I'm going to cover up your ears and your skin and your olfactory nose and mouth. But this time, open your eyes. And men, as time again, see these stars. These stars get into where we're talking about the next nearest star to the sun being coming to 700 million miles an hour, 4 2/3 years. And so none of the stars we're looking at, maybe light has been coming to us for 100,000 years at 700 million miles an hour. Men see fantastic distances. And you see the dynamic of it is 700 million miles an hour. Now I'm going to have a chart. I start to put on here these four senses, and I put down 10 miles and 10 feet dynamic, which we call in relation that to a mile, we call it a 500th of a mile. I got 1/500 of a mile static and 10 miles an hour on the first point. And this is on a chart, very easy to put down these two things, the static and the dynamic on the chart. I got the touching is here, and then here we come to the smelling, and here we come to the hearing. But when I want to get to the fourth point where I can see, I have to take an airplane. It's so remote from these, I have to take an airplane to get there. By the time I get halfway to it, these other three have welded into one. As you get far enough away from stars, we find the first three are very close to one another, and the fourth one is so remote from it. Now, next thing we know is that a little baby is born. Time and again, these little tiny babies haven't been born for a day. And you're in his presence there, and you see it lying in bed. But something you notice is hands seem to move deftly. They don't seem to be sort of jerking. The fingers seem to close. You instinctively put your finger in the child, baby's hand, and close it on absolutely firmly. You want to move your hand away, and the child seems to let go. It's amazing, so this child seemed to be communicating to me with his hand. It seemed to have real feeling. This ought not to surprise us, but we tend to say baby's just been born. But the baby's been in the mother's womb for 9 months, and it's been 8 months, and really is in tactile communication. So that's highly developed. That's the only communication it had, was tactile. So it's very well developed. Then it is in those terms that we then say feet. We use hands and feet, or distances of tactile, to talk about the measurement. In other words, everything goes back then to the otherness. We start with tactile. And tactile is so very prominent, being the principal one, then everything else is ratio to it. This means then when we get to something like speed of light, it's so fantastically great, man up to now has been thinking about it being instantaneous. Thinking about being instantaneous, therefore, you think you see me over here, but you don't. Light is bouncing off me, and by the time it gets through you and then back in here, it's so quick, it takes only about a billionth of a second for you to bounce off me and be in your brain.
Hi.
This has a whole lot to do with a great deal of misinformation that we are able to carry on today reflexively. Once you've thought what I'm thinking through here, you yourself will be much more cautious. That's why I really want to finish this with you. Thank you very much.